Today is September 24th, right? 23rd. And speech and Steve will do a presentation on Holy Speech. So we will give him his time. And after he's finished, we can have some things he will ask us. And then I can add some of my thinking. So please, Steve.
Thank you, Ty. Thank you, friends, for allowing me this opportunity to share what I learned and what little I know about Holy Speech. I hope that I can communicate this in a clear way, and I hope you gain some benefit from it. Right speech. The third factor of the Noble Eightfold Path has characteristics that would include truth, understanding, harmony, loving kindness, and added to that definition would be a thought that, that there's meaningful conversation involved also. Traditionally, there are four categories that are broken down in...
Would you repeat those characteristics?
Sure. They came off the top of my head a little bit. things like loving kindness and okay. Truth and deep listening. Those characteristics that I just gave Elaine are going to come out a little bit more of these four characteristics a little more clearly. The Buddha spoke of four distinct characteristics for right speech. And there are various definitions, each having, I think, its own their own qualities. So I'm going to give you the Thich Nhat Hanh definitions, and then other definitions that I've come up with that are, in some ways, I think, equally helpful. So the first factor is speaking truthfully. And another definition could be abstaining from fake speech or false speech. It's pretty self-explanatory in the two definitions, I think. So looking at this first aspect, it becomes apparent that when we speak untruthfully, when we speak with the intention to mislead or misguide, it's very easy to see how we would create division or discord or mistrust from our words, that when we misrepresent ourselves and someone doesn't exactly quite know how to interpret us or how to take our words, then there's a level of trust that isn't there. So further listening on that person's behalf might not be very meaningful. They might stop listening to us very quickly. The second characteristic, and this is the one that I feel has two definitions, and I'm sure it's a translation preference. And in these two translations, I think there's a lot of meaning. So the first translation would be not speaking with a forked tongue. And it's also described in certain texts as slanderous speech. I think the first definition, speaking with a forked tongue, does a very good job of giving the idea of saying one thing to one person and saying a completely different thing to another person. Again, misrepresenting our true beliefs or our thoughts, creating mistrust between, not just between the two separate people you're talking to, but creating mistrust between yourself and those individuals once they realize that you're going to go and relay other information or different information to the third party. And then in the definition of abstaining from slanderous speech, I think this gets a little bit more to the idea that, and we'll come back to this a lot throughout this, is the intention of our speech. So speech that's intended to create division, speech that's intended to create discord. And throughout this entire training, part of the path, intention is a very big key, and it was revealed more and more to me as I went through this that the intention behind our words is always sort of was always kind of my answer to, well, how does that happen, or why does that happen, or what would be the right thing to do? And it was the intention that it kept coming to. So, you know, the training that Wendy did last week, or the factor of the path that Wendy did last week of right thinking, right intention, is a very, very natural transition as we go through it. And I'll elaborate a little bit more on that as we go through. So again, I think if you misrepresent yourself to one person and then talking to another person, so speaking with a forked tongue, again, your intention might be to deceive. Your intention, it might be to mislead. Your intention might be to create an enemy or an ally, which has in it some unwholesome characteristics. The third factor, not speaking cruelly. And then again, a very similar second alternative definition is obtaining from harsh speech. So abusive speech or insults, even sarcasm, definitely sarcasm. The intention behind those practices or those types of speech are intended to hurt. They're intended to create division. They're intended to create discord. An antidote to this would be loving kindness, would be choosing your words that are going to promote harmony, or choosing words that are going to promote self-confidence. The fourth factor. In this factor, I believe that the two definitions, just like in the second, have different meanings. We'll get into a little bit. The first definition could be not exaggerating or embellishing. And then this is the one that I really scratched my head with for a little while. Abstaining from idle chatter is how it's also described. And this in particular, this last probably interpretation of the fourth characteristic, that poses some interesting problems, which I'd like to get into a little bit later. I'm kind of going with an overview to start with. So yet again, exaggerating, saying you've done something that you haven't, or embellishing facts. These are all very related. I mean, it's not truthful speech. It's going to come out that sooner or later, most likely, that you're not speaking truthfully. Trust is going to be gone, and when someone doesn't have that trust, they're going to shut off. They're not going to listen to you. So even if you have the most important point in the world to get across to somebody, not using these four characteristics, they're not going to listen. So your speech is not only going to be unmindful and not right speech, it's going to be useless speech, in that there won't be a hearer. There won't be someone listening to you as deeply as they could. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the fourth mindfulness training as an untraditional example of a definition for this. So I'm going to read through this and kind of, you know, pop your eyes around and say, hey, that's number one, and look around. So for those of you who are familiar with it, you get to hear me read it. So the fourth mindfulness training. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am determined to speak truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I will not spread news that I do not know to be certain, and I will not condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord, or that can cause the family or community to break. I am determined to make all efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. So that's, I think it's a fantastic definition. And it's actually how Thich Nhat Hanh starts out the chapter on right speech. This is right speech. And I think in his way, in rewording the fourth mindfulness training, he did an excellent job of giving a beautiful definition of what right speech truly is. So as I mentioned earlier, that intention is going to play a very important part in all of this, and it's been described that intention is our internal speech, our internal thoughts, the things that we're thinking, the things that are in our mind, and our speech along with our actions. But our speech is the audio cassette of that. Our speech is the megaphone for our thoughts. What's in our head most likely will come out in some way, and that way could definitely be speech. Making sure it's right speech has a lot to do with whether the intention is right, whether the intention is to do harm, or whether the intention is to create trust. The definition of right speech out of the way, we can get a little further into it, and in getting further into it, habit energies start to play an interesting point, in that we may have all the desire in the world to say and do the right things, particularly to our family and our loved ones, but it seems like our family and our loved ones are the ones we hurt the most with our speech. I know that I've said things to my family that I would never say to a stranger on the street. A lot of that can come from habit energies. We can be so blocked with our suffering and so internalized in our own thoughts and our own struggles that we're completely unmindful of our thoughts, and that speech goes right from the action right to the words, and there's no thought involved. It goes right through there, and we don't process it. We don't have the filter of mindfulness looking at it. And we can hurt very, very quickly by doing that. And interestingly, this was definitely something I didn't think of, that speech, whether it's right or wrong, whether it's beneficial or harmful, can take a very long time to manifest. And I'm sure we can all remember things that were said to us. When I was in elementary school, I remember this clearly, trying to read a word, and the word was seesaw. And I couldn't for the life of me pronounce the word seesaw. And I looked at it, and I kept pronouncing words in my head that didn't sound like it. And I remember how that teacher made me feel with her words about reading, that it was years before I felt comfortable reading to somebody else. And it was only her words. She didn't act. She didn't hit me. She didn't do anything physical. It was only her words that created this enormous block in me. So that was that came to me in doing this, of there's a really large time delay. If we push somebody, there's an action, and then there's real, it's immediate. But if we say something to someone, that seed we're planting most likely isn't going to ripen for quite a long time, and it can be surprisingly harmful. And in the example that I showed you, and I'm sure each of you have something similar that someone has said in your past that's still lingering. So mindfulness is our way through our habit energies, transforming those habit energies. Another tricky spot with right speech is the truth. We're told not to lie. Speak truthfully. Sometimes that's not a reality, though. Sometimes we're in a situation where in telling the truth, we cause the person to suffer more than we would if we remained quiet. But remaining quiet isn't an option. And the advice or the training through this minefield would be to very skillfully choose your words that represent as close to the truth as you can, with the intention, and it goes right back to intention, to not hurting the individual. Because hurting, the minute you say something that the other person is not going to be able to ingest, it's automatically wrong speech. So choosing our words and having the intention to help, and having the intention to realize the other person's needs and move them through a situation is the key. So that even though we may not be representing the truth as we see it, then the karmic result is just as beneficial had we said exactly the truth and they were able to hear it. That karmic result is just as wholesome, because our intention is to help them, our intention is to give them words that inspire them, that move them in a direction that hopefully maybe someday they'll be able to hear the truth that we were intending to tell them. So,
what do you mean by that?
That
give us an example or something?
Someone might not be ready to hear something. So you present it in a different way, maybe half of what they're ready for, and hopefully in the future, with love and kindness and support, they might be in a different place to hear all that's on your mind. But just because it's on your mind and just because it's true doesn't necessarily mean it's right and it's what they need to hear. Is that explanation clear?
Okay.
So at the foundation of all of this is deep listening. This took me a little while to get my head around as well, that in the training on speech, the first thing that we need to do is actually be really good at listening deeply, truly understanding. And after thinking about this and doing some more reading, it seems very evident that our goal is to present things that help others, that don't cause anybody to suffer needlessly, words that inspire, not words that harm. And if we don't fully understand that other person, we're not going to be able to offer those words. We're not going to be able to present our words, our thoughts, in a way that's going to be helpful, beneficial, kind, loving. So for this practice of right speech, we're encouraged to act like Avalokiteshvara, who is a deep listener who listens to the cries of the world and is then able to help. Avalokiteshvara, it's never said, helps the world while listening. It's always a deep listener who then helps the world from that understanding that's gained. And when we're listened to, we're understood. Whether there's a solution or not, if someone listens to us and is able to hear our side, we feel better, regardless of if the outcome is how we want it to be. So I think that's an excellent example of opening those channels up with our families, with our friends, with our community. So how do we listen like Avalokiteshvara? That seems like an important question if at the root of right speech is deep listening. So there are four things that I'm going to put up on the board. So deep listening, number one, so don't judge when you listen. Second would be don't criticize. Third is don't condemn. And the fourth is don't evaluate what they're saying. We listen for no other reason than to gain an understanding of what that person is saying, and we listen for no other reason, if there is suffering there, to help relieve that suffering. If it's truly declarative and someone's going off, then we just listen to understand their point of view, whether we agree with it or not, whether it's their our views or not. In the highest practice of deep listening, wouldn't even matter because we're not judging, we're not criticizing. So I thought it would be interesting to offer an exercise that would give us a chance to practice these things, to not judge, to not to criticize, not to condemn, and not to evaluate. So I've chosen an article to read, actually excerpts from an article that I'm going to read, and I extend to you the opportunity to open up and practice these four things. I can't imagine anybody in this room would agree with these thoughts, but the article is chosen because I'm pretty sure that all of you naturally would have a reaction, which is what we're trying to watch. So having the reaction, it's not good or bad. I welcome you all to recognize it. Wow, that made me criticize, and just walk away, migrate back to my words. And then if you feel like I'm really getting under your skin, then just sit and breathe and tune me out, and it'll be over shortly. I had a very long conversation with the pal last night at a local pub. Neither of us were buying anything alcoholic, but the discussion was heated nonetheless. He believed the best law passed in recent decades was the one enabling the suffrage of women. My position is that the law enabling women the right to vote was one of the worst laws ever passed, and letting them run for office is just as bad. Women are emotional beings, unable to process thoughts before performing common actions. When women act before thinking, we see irrational decisions made. Women are very self-absorbed, thinking first about themselves and their families before thinking of needs of others. Even when they say they can care about society, their inability to focus on the needs of everyone in a situation leads to circumstances beyond their control. Women are easily intimidated by force brought on by others, but can be even more intimidating when they have been given the power of force, especially when granted by government. Women have been known to shoot others in the midst of passion and have been known to completely black out that use of force when questioned about it. Women have proven that their ability to comprehend the basics of freedom is lacking, as is shown with the many pro-status women politicians. Women on both sides of the political spectrum find themselves voting for status measures no matter what their campaign platforms are. The wide emotions of women can also cause them to become incredibly moody and depressed. When a woman is in control of a situation, depression can cause others in the situation to decide against continuing the relationship. The flip side of the depression issue is that women can also be incredibly manic, performing actions that they are elated, while they are elated, that they may come to regret. But women will never admit guilt over such actions. Many women can see past their own needs. They still don't always see all sides of a situation. Many situations are more complicated than just two individuals having needs to be met. Putting a woman in a situation with dozens or millions of needs can be more than a woman can handle. Women are unable to control their spending. They go on shopping sprees and buy goods that are not necessary for lives. Sometimes these spending sprees can affect the entire family when they are exceeding their ability to repay. Why would you want a woman voting for how to spend your money? Women are incredibly vengeful when someone performs an action they don't agree with. Women can hold a grudge for a very long time, which can cloud their vision when having to deal with someone on a repeated basis. Women are one of the greatest oppressors of other women, being known to gossip and speak ill of other women. Women have been known to not accept other women who may have better traits than themselves, such as better-looking women, wealthier women, and women with more attractive spouses. A woman with power might desire to harm other women just out of spite without contemplating the harm brought to the other woman or themselves. So you can see, it is my opinion that a woman's right to vote and run for office is one of the worst laws ever created. The proof is evident as the slide toward tyranny rests partially on the shoulders of the voting women of the U.S., as well as women in office. The only problem I have beyond women is men. If you'd kindly reread this article and replace the word woman with man and woman with men, you'll see the other equally bad law and ability for men to vote, for men to run for office. They're just as bad and just as unable to cope with power over other individuals. They are just as likely to overspend their own money beyond their budgets, and I would not trust most men to spend my money. They gossip about other men, they hold another man's better traits against them, they're intimidated by force, but they're also unable to control their own use of force when they are in a better position. Women, just as men, should not have the power to take my body, my property, my labor, or my wealth against me or even for me. That is the body of the article. So, how'd you do?
I'm curious how the men did compared to the women, because it was clearly, you know, if that raises for you the same kind of angst that it raises for me, especially as a feminist for years of, you know, thinking about these issues and thinking the same thing that was at the end of the article, and how it would feel to read the whole article again with man in it. So I took the bait.
I sat here and started to chuckle, thinking I'd like to meet the idiot that wrote it.
did you catch yourself judging this man who wrote this article? I can give you his name later if you'd like to email him. Who is he? He doesn't know me.
Cindy, have a question.
As an attorney, I caught my mind like making arguments against it right away. Mm-hmm. But then when I remember this, then I try to just understand what you said. Like, you were speaking a language that I didn't understand very well, just to try to understand it. And I kind of like that. I'm glad that you told us to try to catch yourself and try to watch it. Yeah,
that was another thing I was trying to do, was to say, because I've been in lots of those situations where I'm hearing arguments I completely disagree with, and wondering how to listen to the deep listening. It's hard to when somebody else is reading it than,
sure.
you know, than hearing somebody else and being able to see their body language and hear, you know, and being able to engage in a conversation around it. But how to, like, listen deeply just to the words and removing some of those layers and saying, okay, what's at the base for this person, you know? What's the real thing? Because some, you know, all this other stuff is really extraneous, you know? There are thoughts that have been built to make this argument. What's at the base of it? And I wondered how to get there. I think it can be as emotionally arousing for me when I'm listening to the person, because I'm getting caught up in trying to make arguments. I don't feel like I do that very effectively anyway. So then I just... And then finally, I guess, the example that comes to mind is my in-laws, who are extremely conservative in many ways. And what I've tried to do with them is to not engage around the issues that are controversial, but to engage around who they are, what their regular lives are like. And in doing that, finding common ground, and then maybe having a place to have a conversation about something we might disagree with. And that has, I've felt much, has given them room to not be just on the defensive, but to open as well.
Yeah, and what I found myself doing was, I kept looking at those, and I kept reminding myself everyone's entitled to their own opinion, and trying to hold on to that thought so I wouldn't evaluate, or I wouldn't criticize, or I wouldn't do any of that.
Did anyone expect his ending? Did that... When I read it, it was perfect. I read it with different eyes, because I was looking for something inflammatory, and, I mean, obviously, it's ridiculous for men and women, which we can talk about later. But when I got to the end, I said, that's great, because... When you get to the end, if you were saying, he doesn't know me, men are, and you get to the end and he says those things, so he somehow comes around to it, which over other articles that I found that were purely just hateful, this offered an interesting glimpse that if you did judge him, he openly says at the end that that's not me. Now, this is not right speech at all. Its intention is division. He's intending to get people fired up and riled up. I think he could have sent his message a completely different way that would have had a lot more power, a lot more loving kindness. In writing the article the way he wrote it, he runs into an interesting problem, I think. That if you're not practicing these things in a Buddhist meditation center, if you're just hearing this person talk, or if you're come across this article online, I know in myself, I probably wouldn't have gotten past the first paragraph, and I would have completely missed his point, which is, again, why another way why I think his writing isn't effective, and wrong speech led me to just say, well, I'm not going to bother listening to that. If that was, so take that last paragraph off, the guy is misogynistic and possibly ill-advised in some of his beliefs. Take that last paragraph off, if that was me talking to you, would you respond back to me? would you respond back to me? Would you have the ability?
Well, I guess when I, in the end, it's probably not any better, but what I thought when I was listening to it is, he, like, I kind of, like, replaced woman with mm-hmm. my mother or my sister. Like, maybe that's true about one woman he knows, and he's just kind of embellishing or exaggerating that for all women. But in a way, that's not any better, because it's basically just, like, discounting what he's saying.
And it's putting your evaluations
on. Right, right. It's evaluating it. It's like, it's making it slightly better, but in the end, it's like six of one, half dozen of the other.
At first, I felt myself kind of, boy, I wish this guy was standing here. But then I realized, this doesn't even deserve. This is so unrational. It doesn't deserve a response. And I'd probably just say, whatever, and walk away. I probably wouldn't even get past the second sentence, just because it doesn't make any sense to me.
It was very difficult for me to choose an article, because I first gravitated towards thoughts that were very foreign to my own, and I couldn't get into them. I had no desire to read about some of the topics that I was finding for that exact purpose. And I was going at it from an academic standpoint of, okay, I'm just going to find an article. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do it. Couldn't read, you know, 2 minutes into it to see where it went. That was interesting for me. So I had to find lighter topics.
My motivation in responding to somebody who would communicate that to me would be that to ask questions, again, to try to get at what's underlying it. But also, there's a part of me, and this comes also from anti-racism work I've done, that feels like we can't just walk away from it all the time. We, especially as in the anti-racism work, but, you know, for men in terms of women's issues, there's I think an added responsibility we carry into situations about responding, it's hard, you know, because like I described, I get all emotional and I don't know what to say, and so the asking questions thing to me is one thing, but the motivation to not walk away from it is because I know the suffering that results for, you know, my daughters. This guy doesn't hear from, if we don't engage with people who communicate these things and let them know that their suffering is caused by that, how, you know, they'll just, there's a added likelihood, I think, that it continues. So I guess that's just some thoughts of mine in terms of, I'm still not effective at doing it most of the time, but going in with a kind of loving kindness thought, as I've been making phone calls around the political campaigns, I was doing, last week I caught myself where I started to do the meta. So before I was calling them, I would say, wish them happiness and freedom from suffering. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of, you know, whether or not we agree on political issues or not, this is my effort in doing this work, is to connect with other people and to engage in dialogue and that we want to have in a democracy, for example, or in a community. So those are...
I think our dialogue, I agree with your point 100%. I think our dialogue a lot of times creates more division and discord and does nothing other than puts people on one side of a camp or another, particularly in our political system where we have effectively two choices. And Thich Nhat Hanh talks very clearly about people in the peace movement need to learn how to write loving, kind letters to people in power, letters that they're going to want to read or speeches that they're going to want to hear, in order for them to even get it into my mind or to get it into their mind. Just the same way that people had very important opinions to them online that I was reading. It was clear that they were
this has to happen. This is the way life has to be. Mm-hmm. They're presented in such a way that I just shut off and didn't read their message. So, thank you, Ty.
Mm. Thank you very much. Yes, many things happen in the world right now because our political situation and our economic situations. So people write many different things. You can look on the internet. It's very, very painful and very suffering because I think in their heart there must be very a lot of hatred in their heart, you know, and that's why it's radiated out. You know, when I listen to this article, I can see, I can feel the suffering from the man's heart, mm-hmm. and the hatred from his heart and from his family, where he's grown up. He don't have a chance to, opportunity to expose to, you know, the situation that he can learn a lot. Because this is, when you write something, it's come out from your writing, it's mean, that means from your heart, in order to for you to write something. For you to speak something, so that this man must be have a lot of very suffering. So I just went, once I listen to the oracle, I can see, I can feel the pain and the suffering in this man's heart. Not only for woman, but I think for anyone. You know, mm-hmm. he can see that his thing is mistrust himself and others, and he might be have some. Not very beautiful relationship with his mom, or you know, with someone around him, maybe his partner relationship, and he's not able to overcome that, transform that kind of pain in his heart. So whatever he wrote, it just come out from that. So when we listen, you feel that in your heart, and then if you know careful, we can water the seeds, the emotions like. Erosions in your the chemical is secreting in your mind, in your heart, and so that way when we listen with a calm and clear mind, you can see, you can feel right away the suffering, the divisive language in his writing. And I think it's come from where he from his heart. For myself, I feel that. So he's a victim to the. The divisive language, harsh language. So I think when he first write, he's the first one to feel the pain when he write it. It's come out in his writing. He's the first one to feel that. Not you, not all of us, but he's the one to feel that. So the words for right mindfulness is literal meaning is remember. Literal mindfulness is to remember. So remember not to do things that is cause suffering for yourself and for others. That's what it means. It's literal remember. So the mindfulness here is to remember. And later on, and then it can be translated as awakening or aware. So aware what is going on in your body and your mind. That's important. Remember. Because when you speak something, it's help to remember to say it. Right? It's come out. So you have to generate some kind of language there in order to come out, right? So when it's body, speech and mind, but actually my body and speech. So the mind go through to the body and then it's come out to the speech, the language. But the work mindfulness here before is in the traditionally it says sila or precepts. So because this is the new translation, you know, you can translate as so this is precepts. Or training, and later is come like training. So, the word genesis. So, precept is to train yourself. And because in our Western society, precept is kind of very allergic to us. So, that's why we train it, translate as mindfulness. So precept is, so it's training us to be, you know, kind of awareness. So this is, it's easy to receive when we see the word mindfulness and the precept, because we have some kind of in a religious way, and we say it's precept, and it's, how do you say, you think something is very dogmatic, then it's kind of hard to receive. So we understand the root of it is the precept, and then it's translated as mindfulness, and then the mindfulness translates as remember, and then it's. So this right mindfulness training is very important for every one of us to live a meaningful life, and to live the life that we want. And, but I think everyone is one of that. And when we have, we live in unmindfulness living, then we cause all kind of painful, all kind of suffering, first is for us, and then to others. And as Steve said, the most damage is the one that our loved one, you know, because I don't know why, you know, it's easy to to utter a word out to the our loved one, than you know to the stranger. You don't go to stranger and say, you know, sometimes but not most of the time, right? Because why? Because your loved one, you know, you associate with them all around, all the time, and it's easy. It's easy, you know. To say something that is very, very unmindful and cause a lot of damage, especially for our children. When we say something that is hurtful, our hearts, then it's plain and sees that it's really hard to erase. It's really hard to remove. Every one of us have some kind of experience when we're young. Our parents say something to us, and that kind of image is in us all the time. Sometimes it's crippled, making us, you know, children very easy, crippled for the whole life. If your parent will say something to you, and some children, they are very vulnerable, and the parents say something, or your loved one, your sister, say something, and it's crippled the whole life. You plant something that's really, really toxic. It's toxic. So that's why I use that holy speech, because when you speak something that is mindfulness, you produce some kind of holy, some kind of holiness into that. It's holy speech, you know, the saint, they always speak something very holy. The saint or the enlightened one, they just want to speak something that holy, to plant some holy seeds into the people. So if once we're able to speak something that is nourishing, something that's beautiful, that means we are planning some kind of very holy already, right? So you can say it's a holy speech, you know, holy speech. But it's this is required practice, you know, every day, you know, that's why it's remembering is very important. Every morning you get up, in the morning, remind yourself that today I have to use some nourishing language and some mindfulness language, not to, so that I can nourish myself and motivate myself to work on the path, you know, the whole day. Today I was working outside, and there's a man who bring the brick, and then he didn't know where the address is, and I was running down there, and then I was on my way up. And I was very unintentional, you know, I just run, and then the grasshopper just jump, and then it suddenly jumped right on my feet, and I just step, you know, my step went down, and then it just, well, I have no intentions. And then after, you know, I didn't die yet, but it's kind of, I feel sorry. So I grab and take him up, and, you know, put on the side, and read him a little mantra, loving mantra, you know. If he die, he can go to the pure land. I caused him unintentionally, you know, and then I was aware of that, you know, my foot just put down, then it was on him already, and he's so small, he's crippled, you know? So But at least I remember to do something, you know. If I do something intentionally, I say something love and kindness to him, you know. I say, if you still alive, you should be okay. But if you pass away, you should be going to, you know, I wish you to go to pure land. And at least I give my good thought to it, you know. So I just remember to do that. But I think if you go to the teaching of the heart of the Buddha, and they have a lot of, he says a lot of things on this mindfulness, right mindfulness, which I think is very important in our everyday life. We remember to practice right speech, you know, and deep listening. But I think it's deep listening is first is we have to listen to ourselves, because every one of us, we have suffering. Sometimes we forget our suffering, and our suffering is calling for us, you know. And this afternoon I was working on a bobcat. I forgot myself, you know. It's 1 o'clock already, and my stomach was grouchy, make a lot of noise, and it's calling. You know, it's suffering. My body is suffering because I was so addicted to the work, you know, try to finish the work, but I forgot my body, and I was, it's kind of suffering. My body is suffering, but I so forget about that. So first is listening to our own suffering, you know, in order to listen to other people's suffering. Because why is the Avalokiteshvara he or she able to listen to the cry of the suffering of the world? Because he able to listen to himself, to his own suffering. And because he overcome his suffering, so that's why he have the space to move into or to listen into the cry of the world, of the suffering of the world. First, he had to listen to his own suffering, and when we're able to do that, that's why once we understand our illness, how much we suffer when we are ill, and then once person, oh, say I'm so got ill, and we understand right away. I remember that when I was in the hospital. I so feel so ill. And once I feel that, I go through that kind of suffering, illness. And then when somebody say that, the same problem, the same illness, I say, wow, yeah, I understand, because I already know through it. I went through how much suffering there is. So that's why what I'm saying is, we have to understand, we have to listen to our own suffering. Once we understand our own suffering, then it's easy to understand other people's suffering, very easy. And we're able to, can't easy to accept. But otherwise, if we are running away our suffering, I bet you never going to understand anybody that you say it, but you just only that language exaggerating. So in order to listen to others, you have to listen to yourself, every part of yourself. And this is what is the practice, deep into ourselves, suffering. Why is the Buddha understand other people's suffering, the world's suffering? Because he understands his suffering, right? He's suffering, he has a family, he suffers his family. He know that how much he missed his son when he left his family, his wife, right? He go all through all that himself. So when you love someone and you separate them, he'll go through that. He left his son, his family, so he know that himself, personally. He experienced directly. So the same thing here is, when we're able to listen to someone else, you have to listen to yourself first. Your own suffering, your own pain, your own cripple. You know, every one of us, we have more or less, we have some kind of cripple inside us. Sometimes we don't want to tell the others, because we're afraid of what criticize, right? Yeah. There's a man that he came to me and he said that he's a Vietnamese man and he are very Americanized. And he came to the temple and he wanted to go to the temple, but because he afraid, when his family have funeral and he don't know how to bow, he don't know what to do, and he afraid that if he don't do it right, people criticize him. See, that's what it is, blocking him. So he come along, he talked to me, he said that, can you teach me how to bow, you know, how many bow? I'm afraid because everyone, there's an ego, everyone have their own ego, so afraid of the other people. But he able to come to me, he know that, he come to me, he tells me, I'm not going to criticize him, but I will show him the right way, right? So some people that you're able to expose to your own problem, but some people you can't because you're afraid that they're going to crash and they're going to evaluate you, they're going to put you there. But there is someone that come with the love, with the deep understanding, with the heart, and embrace and receive and share. So he come to me and say, yeah, you come to me anytime. So that's why he afraid come to the temple and say, you know, don't worry, you come here. If you have anything that you don't feel comfortable or you feel free, just come and ask me. You know? And he feel, and then while I was walking along with him, he afraid to tell in public with his parents, but he going to come to say. So there is some kind of us in that, afraid of hurting. You know, every one of us is some afraid, some kind of hurting. Because our parents are not able to listen to us. And first is he not able to listen to himself. And he afraid, and his parents are not able to listen to him. So there is many things that, many conditions, many factors that make us afraid. And cannot speak out. And sometimes we crawl together, you know, like just like a baby. Couldn't make any move. That's why when even we go into big ground, we so fear, because of the fear of hurting, of criticizing, of judging. So we need someone to have the space to listen to us. But if anyone able to do that, he have to do his own, listen to himself first, or herself first. So that's why we are practicing, is able to come back and listen to ourselves. Deep listening is listening to our own first. That's what the difference. And once we're able to permeate that, penetrate that, and then it's easy to listen to anyone. And with an open mind, with no judgment, because you understand yourself how much if you say something that hurt other people and hurt you. So it's very important. So the practice is to come back and take refuge in ourselves and listen to our own vulnerable spot inside us. You can be 30 years old, maybe 40 years or 50 years. Every one of us have a vulnerable spot. And we don't want to express that to anybody. Even our children, your own children, your children, young children too. Because we are afraid of hurting. So that's why what Steve said about that, the story, I can see that and very much. But in order to understand, to see, really see that, you have to open yourself. That's why it's the fourth factor that have to be. If we listen, deep listening with a calm mind, calm and clear, and come back to yourself. And you have the practice of breathing, because there's some kind of judgment coming. And you go and you root in your own breathing, and you can calm yourself. Because when you take a deep breath, that means some kind of there's an energy that comes to calm yourself. So that you have the right to judge, but you have the right also, you have the right to see it. You know? Nobody take you away from the right to judge anything. We have the right. In order to practice, you have to, even sometimes we practice, we have to judge our practice, but we calm our mind. You can see the judgment coming up, the seeds of judgment coming up. Even when I listen to the story, there's emotion arising in me. But I can see that, I can recognize that and take a deep breath and calm myself. So if we listen with a mind of disturbing or distract, then it's easy to condemn. Very easy. This kind of story is very easy to condemn, because the seeds of condemnation in us is very strong. Anything that come say that not in accordance to our view, then we can either judge or condemn right away. And when we use that kind of mental formation, come, and then it's cloudy, your mind already comes, there's some kind of cloud already, and cover your calmness. So the practice of mindfulness is the root is to go back to your own practice. Is if that kind of emotion arises, just come back to yourself and take a few deep breaths. But sometimes you couldn't, because it's too much, it's all too warm, and take a walk, you know, and take a drink, you know, Pepsi. Sweetness. And to calm your emotion down. Yeah, so I just want to share with you a little bit of my insights on the right mindfulness, which is presents by Steve. I just add a little bit more on insight. So hopefully you can make help you to have a more clear view, you know. So thank you very much. So thank you, Steve, for your presentation. I think it's very nice you bring in the story and let everybody engage in. And so it's the presentation is more alive and more involvement of everyone. So I think it's good. That's it. So we will stop here and then we'll have our meditation. So I will invite three sound bells so that we can have a few calm breath and metabolize yourself and calm your emotions.